Hello, lovelies. Welcome to the Fat Joy podcast, where we talk each week about how to flourish in an anti-fat world. I'm Sophia Apostle, a fat professional coach who loves talking to other fat people about what it's like to live within oppressive systems that marginalize our bodies and how we still dare to have the audacity and courage to reach towards our collective liberation and embrace our joy. Please know this is an adult content podcast, so there will be swears, we will be talking about harms we've experienced, and we will be rebelling against weight stigma, diet culture, fat phobia, ableism, racism, etc. You can get more Fat Joy goodness, including how you can support the podcast through my newsletter at fatjoy.substack.com. And for episode transcripts, book reviews, and show notes, head to the Fat Joy website at fatjoy.life. I am so glad you're here. Enjoy this episode. Hello, lovelies. Welcome back to the Fat Joy podcast. I'm your host, Sophia, and I'm joined by Leslie Jordan Garcia today. Hi, Leslie. So happy to have you on.
I am so excited to be here.
We were just for everyone listening, we'd already been talking for like almost 10 minutes and we're like, we should probably hit play. Leslie, I'm trying to remember. I always try to remember like how I found out about you. It definitely was Instagram. And I think it was through your Eat Free, Live Fierce podcast. Cause I'm always, of course, like looking for other podcasts in kind of our area of activism that I can promote and share. And then I like looked at more information about you. And then I went to your website and I was like, oh, can I talk to this person? And you said yes. So thank you so much for being here. I'm so excited about what we're going to talk about today.
And I'm such a fan and a fan of your podcast and of so many of your guests. And I'm just like, when you reached out to me, I was like, she knows who I am. Oh my gosh. Yes. I will talk to you, Sophia, for sure.
I love it. Thank you. So Leslie, why don't you start by telling us a little bit about yourself? Like, what's the work that you're doing in the world? Who are you?
That's a lot.
The smallest of questions.
I know. Just like, you know, it all started on a Tuesday night when I was born in May of 1977. You know, so the work that I do now, So through my own binge eating disorder recovery, you know, back when it was called, you know, ADNOS, just a random disorder with no real name, unless you had a really good fat phobic doctor who told you you were a compulsive overeater, like that far back, you know, all the cool words, you know, that only us OGs know. But I went through my own recovery process, my own healing journey, and still on it, but a little over 20 years ago, and realized that I wanted to help people with eating disorders. So I added on a master's to my already master's program and picked up an MPH, a master's of public health, and got a job in public health, and then realized that they didn't help people with eating disorders. Like, I was like, what? But what they did do was help people living with diabetes. So that's where they stuck me in, and I loved it. And I also saw a lot of overlap in disordered eating with that population, just trying to do the best they could to manage that disease. So my job dried up. It was grant funded. It dried up and I went to teaching. I taught fourth and fifth graders and there was a lot of overlap of disordered eating already in my babies. And it was heartbreaking. And so I started working my way back and I had all these fitness certifications from trying to shape shift my body for decades. And I had this other information. So I got some other certifications and started coaching people on the side. And I came into specifically anti-diet and fat activism in 2017. Like I can remember looking at Roxane Gay's Hunger on the bestseller list.
Like that word even.
That word. I'm like, what does she mean? What does she mean? Hunger? Like, is she looking at me? Is there a camera in this? Who's looking at me? So let me grab this book, right? And I love the title because I devoured it.
Yeah.
I devoured her memoir and I saw so much of myself and my own struggles in that, just trying to carve out a life that was full of joy and where other people would just leave me alone and just let me exist peacefully. And that is what brings me to my work today. You mentioned my Instagram page. I think that is really, really all I wanted to do was to be able to eat free and live fierce. Like, that's it. Just, I won't bother anybody. You know, I promise my fat black body is not catching. Just leave me alone, right? And I'll be okay, and you'll be okay, and we'll all be okay. And that was kind of that moment for me, was understanding that other people that I hadn't seen previously talking about these intersections and the intersections of this healing and recovery journey being talked about, fatness and blackness and intelligence. Like, I just love one of the quotes from that book, like, I'm accomplished, I'm smart, but I'm also a fat black woman. And, you know, my body isn't a testament to who I am and what I'm capable of it. As a plus size fitness person, like all the things, it's just swirling around my head. And I was just like, oh yeah. So, and that was kind of my segue, my on ramp into digging into fat activism and really understanding how and why I had felt called to add a social justice lens to my work.
Yeah, amazing. I'm so glad you did, because that's what we're going to talk about today, right? Is this idea of what is the racialized experience of fatness, of eating disorders, of fitness, and how is that different than often the narrative that gets most commonly shared, which is the white narrative. So I'm so excited to dive into that. But first, I'm going to ask the question I always ask second, which is, what is your relationship with, what has your journey with the word fat been? Like, tell me about fat.
Listening to your podcast, I know this question is coming, right? And I have no fantastic answer. It's so, I'm just like, I've rehearsed it before. Now I'm just like, oh my gosh, what am I going to say? So, truth be told, fat, when I was coming up in my family, was not a negative descriptor. So I know I'm one of the few people that especially on my dad's side, everybody is fat. Actually, I had a hard time growing up because they would say, oh, Leslie, you'd be so pretty if you gained a little more weight. So I had that experience. I know, right? So thank you, Jordan Clan. Like, it was lovely growing up because I didn't have any of that hardship with that word fat. So I'm really grateful for having that cushion, that protective layer, because it served me well. And I don't know how deeply I would have sank had I not had that little cushion when I got out and interacted in the real world. I was a child and young adult in a straight size body. So it wasn't until after my recovery process really started and I stopped the restriction that I became a person in a larger body. And boy, it was a difference. And I feel like I really had to fight to get back to that reclamation that fat is neutral. And more than that, in fact, it's just as beautiful as any other person's idea of beauty. So that's kind of just a short journey. So I didn't have as far to go as other people, but I definitely can relate to being a young mother, not wanting to be so closely aligned with that word outside of my family. Like, it's funny, like at family, you know, fat, whatever, never bothered me because the connotation was always love. But out in the world, it was very different. So just like anyone, you know, plus size, you know, I'm in the South, so big boned, not just bone. You know, there's an extra D in there, big boned.
I love the extra D, big boned.
you wanted words like that, like plus size, of course. You know, curvy wasn't that popular where I was, but definitely plus size. Of course, as a black woman, thick, you know, THICC, those words were, you know, kind of more or less where you aligned yourself. rather than just fat, unless, of course, it was like P-H-A-T, like fat, you know, some trendy spelling or something like that, that just somehow decreased what you thought was the stigma associated with that word. So,
yeah.
And now, you know, it's kind of like, any of them are fine for me now. Like, my body is what it is, and I'm intimately knowledgeable about this body and also intimately accepting of my body. So the words don't bother me. Now, you call me what you want. It's fine. I don't have any shame associated with any of them now. So,
yeah. Well, how did you get to that point of no shame? How did you get beyond just like from neutrality to acceptance and even to love? Right? Like, that's a big journey too.
It is. And everyone's is so unique. For me, again, I think I can go back to seeing all the love that was expressed by the fat Black women in my family with each other, with their partners and husbands and mates, and not ever seeing any shame or much inhibition either, girl, in my family, associated with those bodies. And so I had this, you know, deeper knowing that was okay, that was totally normal, totally acceptable. And my journey really, I had to really process at the intersection of acceptability and race and my size and what was actually in my control and where my self-worth just came from. And once I realized that my self-worth had nothing to do with my body, it just became so much simpler to accept it and become a partner more or less with my body and figure out how to do the things and navigate the world. And I'm just kind of like, huh. You know, I just think back to the setting is like that Star Trek scene where she's like, if nothing's wrong with me, then it must be something must be wrong with the universe. Like, that just became my own inner nerd mantra. Like, it's not me. It's y'all. It's the society. So let me see how I can help y'all out. More or less became my mission. And it is what it is. And it changes still. Like, I'm 46 now, and me and my homegirl perimenopause, you know, me and these hot flashes, and me and, you know, the shifting 10 pounds, like I'm smaller 10 pounds and I'm not, and I have no control over it. It's all hormonal, and I'm just living my life and just going with it. And, you know, when I notice pants are tight, I just pick out different pants and go on.
Right? It doesn't change your sense of worthiness because it's not coming from your body size. That's what I had a very similar experience to you with, like, coming to that conclusion, because I think for me, my core wounding has always been around worthiness. And for me, I think I always equated my worthiness with achievement. And so my fat body was like the biggest failure. And so that uncoupling my worthiness with body size as a failure. And also, I've been learning, thanks to Trisha Hersey, Rest is Resistance, trying to uncouple my sense of worthiness with achievement, which I feel like that might be more of a lifelong thing for me, is like, it all is so connected. Like, do I actually believe when I tell myself I am worthy exactly as I am? Like, I say that to myself a lot. But can I believe it? I try every day.
That resonates, because even in a large body, and I was a heavier kid, but I wasn't, you know, necessarily like out of straight.
You were big boned.
Yeah, big boned girl. And I was an athlete, and I was a great athlete. So I had one of the, you know, for those who aren't familiar with Stacey Bias's, you know, 12 fat archetypes. Like, I was one of those. I was the fatly. I was also gifted and talented. Like, I literally ran my school's program as a student. Like, the teachers are just like, oh, she's got it. So even in my body, I was always able to achieve. And it was but it was also that intelligence that really set me up for the intersection that race, because I was in a small town here in Texas, and it came time for me to graduate high school out of 10th grade. I had finished. I was done. I had met all the state requirements. And literally my parents and I were told at a school board meeting that there had never been a white kid who had tried to graduate early, and they were going to let some little black girl who was actually an outsider to the community be the first one.
Oh my God. Like, they said those words. That was
literally said those words to my parents. My parents had been driving to Austin to meet with TEA and pulled, you know, precedents and, you know, all this stuff, because I had been working in high school on my high school stuff since I was like in the seventh grade. So I was done. And that was probably the most damaging blow to my worth, to my worldview, that if you produced, right, if you worked hard, you would have. That wasn't true. And it was a shock to me, and it was devastating to me. You know, I bust my little tail being in UIL, like academic competitions and all this stuff. And then to be told that I wasn't going to be able to have what was literally rightfully mine because of racism in this town. And that really made me look at who was successful. And it was the skinny people, like people who were smaller than me. And how could I get that? You know, like, I can't change my blackness. You know, that's, I'm stuck with that. So how do I navigate this world that, oh, looks at me as a black person and therefore set limits on what I'll be able to do despite my efforts? So that was an underlying theme of like that hurt, that to my value, like my worth had never been tied to my race either. And so my lack of worth was now being tied to my race, and I didn't understand it. And I was in high school. I was 15 years old when that happened. And it really informed the way I moved through life.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and your website, I joked with you when we started that I actually copied two paragraphs from your website and put it into my show notes, because I was like, it's so profound what you write here. I'm going to quote you to you, if that's okay. I love this. You said, the betrayal, and this is you, the betrayal she felt from her own body and society became the catalyst for her battle with an eating disorder. How incredible to actually be able to look back, because at the time, I imagine as a 15-year-old, you weren't super aware of it, but now looking back, that incident of racism led to, well, I guess I'll do this now. I guess I will try to minimize the size of my body.
Yes. And by minimizing, and of course, looking back, you know, hindsight's 2020, right? Not only just minimizing the size of my body, but also minimizing the attention that my blackness got, right? So it wasn't just about being smaller to me at that time. I look back and it was also like, well, if I'm smaller, I will seem less intimidating, less loud, less black, less all the things that you're telling me that black women are. And I mean, I started with the perming, the relaxing, the straightening the hair. And I mean, I was a mess like back then. Like, it was a real struggle like back then. And I had great parents who just did not get it. Like, I was trying to articulate, like, they won't let me do it because I'm black. And I just never forget, my dad was like, Leslie, you're going to be okay. Because, like, seriously, I was shot at as a veteran for being black when I came back to this country from Vietnam. Like, I've had dogs turn on me for racism. Like, girl, they told you no. Like, we're just gonna, you're fine. Like, you know, so to my parent, my mother was just like, girl, bye, we integrated schools. Like, girl, you're gonna be okay. And, you know, but to me, that was devastating, you know. And they didn't mean to like minimize it, but my parents just didn't know how deeply that affected me. Like, I just, and my parents, I just stopped talking about it with them because it was like, I wasn't getting anywhere. And then, you know, and then there were some other avenues we took. I took a GED. I barely made the GED requirement, got out of high school and with a GED and just went on about my life. Like, I left that school, you know, went on to college and at 16. But I still had all these things. So now I'm in a new environment. I'm in college. I'm 16. I'm staring out because I'm 16 and in college. Still in Texas. And it was just things I couldn't manage. Like, and I didn't feel like I didn't want to bother my parents because, you know, this was small potatoes compared to things they had went through. And so it just got worse. It spiraled. I isolated myself. Gosh, no one with an ED has ever done that before, right? I just isolated myself and tried to restrict, and I felt great and productive, right? And I felt like I was doing the right things and I was being morally validated, right? All the things. And then my body was like, can we please have sustenance? And so then I'd binge, right? And then that went on for another 10 years before I got help. And so, so it was so surreal now to look back and just think of like, wow, when Kimberlé Crenshaw coined that term intersectionality, like, wow, I can look back at the intersections. I can look back at, that was a poor, smaller town in Texas. Like, there wasn't much mobility. Like, I can just look at all these things, you know, and say, yep. the more intersections, the worse it gets. Like, that's exactly what happens. And then I started looking at it from these systems of oppression. Like, oh, because this is a falsehood that we are indoctrinated in. No, you go to school, you go to college, you work hard, you will have. I did all that, and that is having is not where, you know, that doesn't happen that way. It's just because of all the other things that are designed and in place and self-perpetuating to minimize your opportunities and keep people don't hire you. And just because you have these educated, they don't hire you. Like, it's a whole thing. Like, it's just, it's so real. So abolish the systems, because the systems of oppression are alive, and and unfortunately, they support each other and they work extremely well. They're good at what they're designed to do, and that's oppress people.
100%. Yeah. And you're right about how well they interlock together to keep us a certain way. I know. Yeah. Oh, I keep hoping someone's going to come on and like have the answer. But it's so fucking complicated. And it's, I know. It's really, when you start, I feel like as I started to learn about the way the systems worked and how they impacted me, and then, of course, because it was all about me, it still is, but also looking elsewhere around and how it's impacting us as like groups of people, it is so perfectly designed. Like, someone wrote this script. Well, we know who, the very rich white dudes wrote a script so that no matter what racialized and marginalized people do, it doesn't matter. And there's so much grief in that. Like, I think about that a lot, because it's the injustice of it is like, how do we keep going forward once you see that truth, Leslie? Like, how do you wake up every day and continue fighting?
So, you know, we have this term, you know, now it's, you know, you see it everywhere, resiliency, being resilient. And I think I don't want to actually have to be resilient, guys. Like, that's, I am, but only because I have to get up and keep going, right? Not because I just think, oh, you know, where is it? But to me, that is what eating free and living fierce is all about. It's all about my own individual liberation within these systems of oppression, right?
Yes. We'll say that again. Individual liberation.
Individual liberation within systems of oppression.
That's beautiful.
Because once I'm liberated, anyone that I touch or influence or impact, I can help them find it for themselves. And so that's become my whole like mission. I have daughters, and my youngest daughter has Down syndrome. So, oh man, when you talk about, I'm all over everywhere. Like, I'm looking at disability activism. I'm looking at racialized activism. I'm looking at to be an ally for the LGBTQIA population, because I recognize as a free mind now, and as a free spirit, and as a liberated person, I recognize my humanity in other people. Like, when I see other people, I think, oh, we are together, because we're both human, and I can recognize and empathize with your experiences, whether they're mine or not.
That's really powerful.
Thanks. But that's why I'm like, let's go. Like, I'm just like, they did what to who? Like, you know, I'm everywhere because I just, it's to me, it's just so intrinsic to who I am now.
Yeah.
We're all human and there's this, you know, infinite experience spectrum and there's this infinite expression spectrum and we're all navigating this. And I know that if, as one individual, if I can help another individual, and then now we're a team. And if we can help another team, and now we're a group, and now, you know, if groups help groups, and now we're a community. And that is where the change is actually going to happen, when communities are liberated, because the systems will no longer have the effect on us in the way that they do. And I think that's why healing and intersectional healing is such a powerful social justice movement. Like, you're doing this to me, but I'm going to live, thrive anyway.
Yeah. I love that. Intersectional healing. So true. Well, and that really ties in to the work that you do around eating disorders and disordered eating. And one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you was this idea of how is it different for people who are racialized than non-racialized people. Can you speak to a little bit of what the experience is, the extra layers that are part of that, if it's like a white person having eating disorder treatment versus a Black person getting eating disorder treatment?
I think the biggest difference is that when I was in outpatient treatment, like going through therapy, like a lot of the skills that they would try to teach and get you to use just don't work when you're in a racialized body. Like, I think of CBT skills and just like being or even some of the mindfulness work, which I'm not anti-CBT or anti-mindfulness, or like mindful eating. And I love mindful eating. I talk about it. It was a game changer for me once I got to some certain other pieces together. But I mean, taking 30 minutes just to enjoy a sandwich at your desk when you're Black, when everyone's staring at you like, oh gosh, is that Black girl ever going to go back to work? Like, I don't think they realize how hyper-policed our bodies are, like in workplaces. And so a lot of these skills that they give you to try to help you eat and process what's going on in your body, like, you just don't have time or the ability to do it because you have your spidey sense for, is this going to be a microaggression? Am I, my body can't relax because I'm gearing up for this attack that I don't know when it's ever coming. So I'm always amped up. I'm always
vigilant.
You know, I'm hypervigilant. Like, I never know whether it's going to actually happen to me or someone I know, if I'm going to have to watch a replay of some violence on the news every time I flip on to any TV or social media account. Like, how many times am I going to be insulted and assaulted with these images that could very easily be me, if they're not me or my family? You know, like, it's hard. How do you relax in that situation? It's like, you know, you can't. And that's part of what the Black experience is in this country. That's a big part of just knowing, am I going to be able to survive? And, you know, growing up and, you know, I was a dare kid. Oh, gosh. Ooh, I don't know if they have when you were in Georgia for a while. So, you know, dare all about drugs. And I'm just like, no wonder these people are on drugs, because they are trying to escape this hypervigilism. Like, and I didn't understand that as a kid. And like, now I have empathy for that situation because it's just so different. And when you go to treatment centers and they don't have hair care products that will work with your hair texture, and you've got to, you know, like little things like that just make such a world of difference to feeling welcome, to feeling a sense of belonging. And they're absent for Black people. And I think that's part of it. And then even within our own communities, what we still know and believe and think about eating disorders, like, oh, that's a skinny white girl problem, or affluent skinny white girl. I mean, I know growing up, Karen Carpenter, that movie came out about her life in the 80s, a made for TV movie, the Karen Carpenter story, and how she suffered through anorexia. And that was it. Like, everybody who suffers with anorexia looks like that, you know, like, so you can't be suffering from this or this because we didn't eat today. Well, now we know that food insecurity only triggers and grows and increases your risk for binge eating and other eating disorders, things like ARFID. Like if you learn about something or struggle with something, like just it's all so connected and no one is talking about it, because the idea is that your eating disorder is largely because you're trying to control something or some, you know, issue about your body and you want to look like this. But there's so much more to our mental and emotional health that food becomes a crutch or a punishment or a reward so easily, because as humans, we all must eat to survive. And so food sets itself up. It's set up to be a coping tool, you know, and in Black culture, like just historically, pulling resources together at holiday times and having all these big elaborate, you know, celebratory meals creates a scene for binging. And then when you're sad, that's what you go back to. You're trying to recapture that feeling of connection, of family, and, you know, and your emotional awareness is hijacked. So you binge and your stomach's distended and now you're uncomfortable and you're constantly told that you're not good enough, you're not valued, you're less than from everything. And I'm not just saying it's in our mind, it's the way Black women are paid. Takes, you know, months for a Black woman to make the same salary that a white woman or really far for a white man to make doing the exact same job in this country, in the United States. So you have all these things that constantly tell you that you are worth less just by your existence, right? You exist in this body, therefore you are worth less.
Hello, Fat Joy friend. I'm popping into this episode to give you an exciting update. Fat Joy is now ranked in the top 2%. 2% of all 3.4 million global podcasts, which is a really big deal. You may have heard, because I've been talking about it, that I am aiming for this podcast to hit the top 1%. And you can help the podcast get there by making sure you've subscribed to the podcast and giving us a 5-star rating. And if you want to be a little extra, I love extra. If you've gotten something out of these episodes, if they've supported you in some way, please write a review for the podcast. I love these. I put them all on the website. They mean so much when they come in. No surprise, I believe that fat stories are worth telling, and I am so grateful to bring you a new story each week and honored that you keep coming back to listen. So thank you, lovely, and enjoy the rest of the episode.
And processing that, when you're so dissociated from your body, you're trying to separate everything about your body from the actual physical body you're in, trying to find a place for you to fit in. And I think that those are the things that are at the heart of why traditional treatment models don't work, because they're assuming that you're in a body that will be able to reacclimate and assimilate just, you know, right away, and you won't feel any of these other outside issues anymore. But so many of the issues we're feeling are even before some of the other ones that are traditionally thought to be what bring on eating disorders. So that intersectionality and just those added layers of different identities is very tough, because no one studies treatments with Black people or Black participants in these studies. So just the racialized difference in our experience within the world makes it very, very, very different.
100%. Yeah. I love what you said. Like, it's such a stark difference between like someone in a white body kind of returning back to their world. That's assuming that the only factors that are at play are at the level of the individual. Whereas what you're speaking to is like, yeah, sure, there's the individual level. There's also the interpersonal level, the organizational or like workplace level, and the larger societal cultural level too. And none of those levels are being brought in to, well, I don't think educated people aren't being like the helpers, the eating disorder therapists, the counselors, no one's being educated around these extra layers, the intersectionalities that exist. So then it's not brought into treatment. And then so the impact, I imagine, is that you, I don't know, but do you find that racialized people just feel even more wrong because this thing that's supposed to work isn't working the way it's supposed to? Is that what happens?
I think some of them do. I think some of them continue to internalize that it's them. Yeah, for sure. And then, or you have treatment clinicians who say things that create more harm, and you're not getting any help, and so you exit the program, you exit the treatment, or, you know, I feel like there has been probably a lot of that, and still, and, you know, if you're being treated in, like, California, where there's maybe some more diversity among the clinicians, than if you're being treated in Idaho, So there will be differences in who they've had experience in working with and what they're saying. And I just think that there needs to be some work around even how we assess for eating disorders. Some of the questions don't really speaks to different cultures. The wording, the phrasing of the questions, the scale of the questions don't accurately reflect different backgrounds and different cultures.
Can you give us an example, Leslie? I feel like I really feel this, like even at the point of intake, we're not getting it right.
Yeah, even at the point of intake. So I think about the eating disorder scale, like when they ask questions about frequency of binging or severity of binging or even like worry, feeling anxious. Like a lot of the phrasing, Black people, especially because that's what I am, I'm Black, we don't describe those same feelings in the same way. So there have been a couple of studies that have shown this more than once, and for different things like with depression or anxiety. You're asking me, am I depressed or am I anxious? And really what I'm thinking is that I'm just worried. So I check no. when really I probably likely should have been yes. But really the question should be more inclusive to the way things are expressed within cultural context, but they're not. So a person from a different background may, oh no, see, that's not me at all. But really they're being missed because the questions are not culturally competent. I think the same way about body image, you know, maybe I want to be smaller, but not too small. So no, I really don't have a problem there. But would I like to be, maybe am I being told I need to be wider or something? Like there are just so many different questions that I just feel like would be a better assessment tool. And if you're tying your treatment framework to the assessment tool, then there we are. It's like certain things are going to get seen and certain things are just going to be reinforced by the treatment and perpetuating harm.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that's just one example, but.
Yeah, but that's so important. Like if we're not even getting the words to convey, the words to assess emotion, if we're not using the right words, I mean, like we got to stop right there and fix that. So how do you work with people, Leslie? Like how have you created a different framework that does take into account a larger definition of culture, of racially marginalized people? Like how did you develop this and how is it different?
So for me, I basically started with all the things I kind of wish someone had talked to me about. And so for me, I work with my individual clients in like a three-part process. We really talk about individual identity first. I'm super nosy. I mean, I'm intimately nosy with my clients. I want to know how you see yourself, what events, positive or negative, affected your view? How do you feel about your culture? Anti-Blackness is something that's so internalized by non-Black people and Black people. So I always dig in, like, are you like power to the people? Or are you like, no, those are people over there? No, I'm trying to be like I would, as far removed from that identity as I possibly can be, right? So I dig and I ask questions about why that is. I'm also going to talk to anybody you'll let me talk to. I will talk to your siblings. I will talk to your parents, your spouse. I will talk to your parole officer and have talked to probation officers. I will talk to people that you socialize in your sororities or your churches or your next door. I will stalk you on next door and see what kind of comments you're like. I'm very that's probably the most work intensive part of getting to know someone for me. And while I'm doing all this digging with my clients, we are talking about basic coping skills, like just in that day. And I have a knowledge when you tell me, yeah, these people on my work, you know, it's hard out here for a Black woman or a Black man or even a Latina. Like, I understand, like, I know what you mean. There's less conversation about trying to explain what you mean. There's more of an understanding, even though situations are different, but we just kind of have a different operational understanding. And we start from there. And then we dig into where your food and body challenges stem from, if there's any deeper healing. Some of my clients are in therapy, and we have documents where we can share information about shared clients so that we're, you know, so we have a coordinated care team for that person. And then some of them are just needing some skills. Like, I've gotten to this point and I recognize where they are, and I work with them. Some of them don't want to let go totally of their eating disorder behaviors, and I understand that. So we talk about harm reduction and how to be as safe and healthy or as well as you want to feel within the parameters in which you are, you know, ready and willing to live within. So I really have had to work hard not to make my goals the goals for my clients. So
yeah, that is kind of hard because you start. I know with my clients, I want for them so badly. Yeah, but holding that distance is important. Yeah,
yes, it is. It is, because then I'm not doing them any good. I may be pushing them in a way that they're not ready, and. I know what it's like to not have autonomy, and I just cannot do that to any of my clients. So,
right. Well, the whole thing with oppression, oppressive systems, is that it's so non-consensual. And what I hear is like you're breaking that pattern with the way you're doing things. I want to ask about the way you do deep nosy dives into your clients. I think this is brilliant. What do you, when you do this, what's the reason behind it? What does getting to know them, talking to their, you know, almost, you're almost doing what in leadership circles we call like a 360, where you do like, you talk to all the people around them. The purpose of that is what for you? What does it give you as their support person?
For one, it helps me to know or learn about any blind spots they may have to some of their issues and struggles. Also, it helps me learn about what kind of support they have, what kind of obstacles they're going to have. It doesn't help me to help them say, do all this stuff when you go home, or gently exercise. And if you just want to lay on the floor for 5 minutes, that counts as movement. If they're in a family that is, you know, they're all ultra marathoners, that family is not going to be able to support them or understand this framework. So I want to know literally about where I can help the most and what I'm up against. Like, it's the best way I can get to know really what this person's life is like, because it doesn't make sense to tell them to do these things that are not going to be sustainable within their circle of support.
Yeah. And that's amazing. Like, that is so different. I've never heard that approach before being done by an individual like yourself.
Well, and it also helps me strengthen their community. Like, I still find, especially with Blacks, and I work a lot with Latinos, like, what we know about eating disorders is not all the time accurate. So it also helps me create rapport with them, and I can trickle in education for them as well.
Oh, that's nice, actually. So you get to educate, and hopefully, I'm just imagining this in my own, I've totally made this about me now. I'm like, oh my God, I wish someone had done that with my parents. It's like
me. No, seriously, I wish someone had done that with me and my, oh man. And my mother was a nurse, and it was just like, my, you know, so yeah, no.
Yeah. Wow. So then when you are working with people and starting to focus on healing and harm reduction, what do you find? I'd love some examples if you have some on, like, what are some of the things that you do that feel very attuned to a racialized person's experience that someone might not get within kind of a regular eating disorder framework?
One of the things, like I mentioned earlier, about like how it's, what it's like to be in corporate. I'm in Austin, so I have a couple of tech individuals who are like in tech, and what that world is like as a Black person, and being able to set, you know, be able to step away, being able to set boundaries as a Black person in your job, and being able to say, no, I don't have the bandwidth for that, or I don't need that project on my desk right now. I appreciate you thinking of me, and I would like for you to continue to think of me. But immediately, setting those boundaries as a Black person is seen as violence. It is seen as confrontational. So battling a lot of that type of thing as a Black person, I understand what that's like. I intimately understand what that is like and how to help them navigate that and also continue to put their own healing first. The inclination is, I need this job. I'm going to do it because I've got to. Now I'm stressed. Now I'm stressed eating or I'm stressed not eating. All the things that go with that, with attaching your worth and your value to productivity, capitalism, system of oppression. So helping them navigate that as a person who has been through that themselves and understanding what that looks like and why it's necessary to, what skill set they will need to, you know, to have in place that they can go back to work and feel like they're still not going to be retaliated against, because that is a very real concern. So things like that. So that those are some of the things that I work intimately with my clients to be able to achieve.
Yeah. And that I've been through eating disorder treatment for my own binge eating disorder, and I worked with a couple therapists. I can only speak from my experience, but I think it's, you know, a reference for other, what, as a white person, what I have also experienced. Like, we never talked about anything related to that. And yet you're so right around that for racialized people, that you mentioned, like the policing, the surveillance, like that has to be part of the conversation because food is intimately wound up in that. I think that's a big leap, I imagine, for even like a lot of people listening to think, oh, why would how I show up at work or setting a boundary at work, why would that be connected to my eating disorder? Because of what you just said. That's why.
When you're in, you have racialized identities, whether you're Latino, Caribbean, Asian, South Asian, and we have food traditions and cultures, and then you get invited to a dinner where they have, you know, fed you, or they're going to feed you tofu and the blandest vegetables they can possibly find because they just want to make sure everyone on their team is healthy. And what you've just heard is that your cultural foods are trash, which means your culture is trash and you're a product of your culture. So you're trash. So like all these things are things that we have to navigate, and we have to be able to help our clients navigate if they have an intersection of racial or cultural identities that is different from the dominant culture, because it will inevitably show up. It's going to show up.
Yeah. Well, and it's so interesting. I did not know until, again, I started following a number of anti-diet and racialized nutritionists and eating disorder therapists and coaches and counselors. I did not know this about the cultural foods piece, probably until maybe like a year or two ago. It kind of came across my eyeballs and I was like, oh my gosh, of course. I hadn't thought, I white privilege, all that stuff. I hadn't thought about that piece. Can you share a little more? Because I don't think a lot of people know about this.
There are super great people who speak about this so well. And for me, it's because I experienced it. So, and had to overcome some of my beliefs. So when I'm talking about like the demonization of cultural foods, it's like, cultures, non-white cultures, are taught that their foods are nutritionally lacking, inferior, and disease-causing, basically.
Mm-hmm. Like fried chicken.
Yeah, which is so, which, and I just want to say here on the Fat Joy podcast that foods that are attributed to Black cultural foods are not even Black cultural foods. So, like, I feel like they forget that Black people have had to just kind of make do because we were colonized on someone else's land. So we were stripped away from Africa, stolen and smuggled over here, and we were colonized here. So we didn't have access to a lot of our cultural foods. And we did bring a lot of our cultural foods with us. So many accounts of the seed weaving into the braids and the patterns bringing okra. And that's how watermelon got here, is we brought it here, peanuts. All these things we brought over here because they learned that their foods was, people were not doing well on the long trip over. So they were like, well, if the women who are going to be enslaved are going to prep the food for the soon to be enslaved people on the ship, they need to be able to have access to things that they're accustomed to preparing. So a lot of it was brought over knowingly and some of it not, but that's, so African cuisine basically is a lot of root vegetables, a lot of vegetables and a little bit of meat. So things like macaroni and cheese are not, is not a Black cultural food. It's a, now it is, now it's like a Southern dish, but how many times have you ever seen Africans share recipes for macaroni and cheese? Like, that's just not something culturally. So, but greens, I love collard greens, sweet, you know, sweet potatoes or yams. Those would be more akin to cultural foods. And candied yams is a dish that, you know, oh, all the sugar that's added. Oh my gosh, it's cultural foods. That's why you have diabetes. Well, that's inaccurate, first of all. That is not what causes diabetes. And adding a little sugar to your candied yams is not, it doesn't replace the nutrition of the yams. I always find this very interesting. Like, they're not less nutritional. They just have a little more sugar. They have a little more flavor. Same with greens. You know, they talk about cooking them with ham hocks or neck bones. Okay, not enough. There's not a lot of meat or fat on those pieces of meat. Those are like scrap meats, but they do add flavor to the greens. Thank you, fat, because it helps my body absorb and break down the vitamins that are in these collard greens. Cooking them that way doesn't decrease the value of the nutrients in the food. I've always find that very interesting. And it's not just Black foods. You think about Latino foods and always talking, oh, tamales, oh, they eat too many tortillas, all this. You know, they have a very fiber, starch, vegetable-rich tradition. They don't eat vegetables in the side dishes like we see in American-style eating. But they add nutrition because there's a handful of onions, peppers, you know, in everything that they make. They add nutrition a lot. So they eat combinations of vegetables a lot. Same with Asian food, you know, Chinese food, especially in America. This is a big deal. They always, oh, you know, this it's high in MSG, it's high in salt, but it's these foods have maintained cultures for millennia. So I'm thinking that they're nutritionally sound. And then, and then they commodify it, right? Then they go and commodify these cultural foods. Now in America, I went to Whole Foods a couple months ago. Hot Bar had collard greens on Whole Foods bar. Then they had messed it up by cooking it with apples. I was just like, oh my gosh, it was weird. But I was just like, raw collard wraps are now a thing. You've commodified collard greens, and now they're expensive to cultures and communities that have relied on them. Same, have you bought an avocado lately? They're super expensive. I remember when they were too fat to be eaten. Oh, guacamole. Now, you know, thanks to keto and Whole30, these trendy diets, they have commodified them and made them. Same with quinoa, a protein rich grain staple from, you know, Meso and Middle America, South and Central America. Now it's, you know, trendy to eat quinoa. And, you know, but these are just things that they've just figured out how to make them more costly and sell them back to the communities that have relied on them for forever.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I just think it's so interesting, the hypocrisy around how 10 years ago, like you said, no one could eat avocados because of the fat. And now it's like, you should be eating an avocado a day because now it's good for you. And we still why on earth would we believe any of quote unquote what they say? Why would we believe it? It changes constantly.
And same with the body standards. And your people are literally dying in these plastic surgery things to achieve a body that will be out of fashion soon enough. But I was caught up in it. I know what it's like to buy that, because I think that being a part of a community and you know, that was one thing I could always rely on. If I didn't know anybody on my job, I could go to the break room, sit down with my lunch kit, and then we could all talk about what diet we were on. Instant camaraderie.
Oh, I get it. And I'm so sad by that.
But it's so true.
I know.
Oh, girl, it's been that way. And we're all silently acknowledging that we're all achieving or struggling to achieve this. So we're also silently asking for grace and acknowledging that I'm working to do something better, quote unquote, better, right? So you know what I'm saying?
That's that achievement worthiness piece again.
Yes, it is. It very much is. And, you know, you can be, you know, that for lack of better terms, it was, you know, your sisters in suffering because, you know, you're not eating this, or you're dreaming of the weekend cheat meal and all the things that I now know. Just know.
Yeah. Just know.
Just know.
Yeah. Tell us about your podcast.
Well, it's not as cool as yours. I started a podcast because I wanted a way to talk to people just like you. I started it and didn't really have any clear direction. And then I stopped posting. I only did five or six episodes. And I just started back 2 weeks ago. And I have a more clear direction because there's yours, there's things that are already so great out there. And I wanted to know what I specifically wanted to share. And what I decided what I really wanted to share was these stories of success and transformation, in that they have come home completely to themselves, and how social justice, how that framework has helped them. And so those are the stories that I will be sharing specifically. And my episodes drop on Thursdays. So I have one coming up with a Chinese American talking about same thing, those things, and how that white body supremacy filters into Asian families, and how community, which I believe is the antithesis to capitalism, is community, and how that community and her friend community really saved her and helped her along her way, and how she facilitates groups now for BIPOC only ED group. So just that transformation. So those are the types of stories that I want to share, because they're healing. And I think for me, intersectional healing it extends past our own body boundaries. When you heal in that way, you really do encompass your community, your culture, and society at large. And I think that in that way, the healing is just intrinsically tied to social justice, and knowing that is really a space for liberation is really what I want people to know. And yeah, and it's just, it's great there.
Yeah. Oh gosh, that's so powerful, Leslie. So let's come to joy. So what's your connection to joy? How do you feel about joy?
Joy is my jam. That's something I say. I teach dance-based cardio classes that I teach for the Y, and I just launched an online membership. And that's literally what the membership tier is called, Joy and Jiggle. Because I always say that in my class, there's joy in the jiggle. Just let go.
Yes.
Just let go. You can't jiggle and hold your body stiff. You have to consciously relax, and the parasympathetic is activated, and everything shakes and And there's joy in that because that's you, that's yours, and it's yours to enjoy. It's, you know, our bodies are pleasure seeking machines. Like we're created for pleasure. We're created to enjoy things. And, yeah, I can't get enough of it. Like, you know, my little one, she's just like, "Mama, look at these fat rolls." I'm like, "Girl, they're great." She's like, "Yeah, babe." You know, it's like, that's just where we live. Like there's joy in being able to express yourself fully. There's joy in being able to partake and relish in a luscious apple or a long, you know, full bodied one, whatever it is that, you know, floats your boat. You have that as a birthright to enjoy those things. And so I'm all about it.
Yeah. Joy and pleasure as birthrights. Absolutely. Yeah. Oh my goodness. Leslie, you are so wise. There is so much wisdom here in this conversation. I feel like you're speaking so powerfully to what is not being spoken enough, if that makes sense. You know, like I feel like this is what the work that you're doing is so important in acknowledging what's true for so many people's lived experience that is getting ignored, willfully ignored at this point. I mean, if you go to an eating disorder treatment and you don't have the basic necessities for like someone's hair, like that's willful ignorance as far as I'm concerned, and I need to do much better. And it's voices like yours that are helping make that change. So just thank you for that work in the world. It's so, so important.
Thank you. I'm doing my part, and I am always so encouraged and uplifted whenever anybody has, like, there's no win too small for me to celebrate, right? You know, like, yes, any of that. Yeah, like.
Amazing. Thank you for being here, Leslie.
Thank you so much for reaching out and having me and having this conversation.
Yeah. Before we go, I'd like to read a poem because poetry can reach our hearts in a different way. Poems can have us feel in a different way. And that's what this podcast is all about. Expanding our hearts, deepening our empathy, and inviting in joy. So each week, you get a new poem. For this episode with Leslie, I was drawn to share a poem called Gather, written by Rose McClarney. Because of the way it explores the different seasons, some filled with blossoming, others not. And it really reminds me of Leslie's journey with the ups and downs of life. And I imagine a lot of us can relate to that. So here's the poem, Gather. Some springs, apples bloom too soon. The trees have grown here for 100 years and are still quick to trust that the frost has finished. Some springs, pink petals turn black. Those summers, the orchards are empty and quiet. No reason for the bees to come. Other summers, red apples beat hearty in the trees. Golden apples glow in sheer skin. Their weight breaks branches, the ground rolls with apples, and you fall in fruit. You could say, I have been foolish. You could say, I have been fooled. You could say, some years, there are apples.
Thank you for joining me today. My hope is that you're feeling a little less alone and a little more seen. So until the next episode, you can find me on Instagram at fatjoy.life, on YouTube at youtube.com/@fatjoy, and on Substack at fatjoy.substack.com. And please do check out the episode notes for how you can connect with my amazing guest and for the links to the poem. All right, lovely. I am sending you off with my best wishes for an abundantly fat joy day, and we'll talk again soon.